From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Black Gold by Thorpe McCluskey. Henry Cabot Wade stood in the small main cabin of the schooner Marianne, his patrician forefinger pointing out a small black cross that enigmatically marked the faded chart beneath his hands. Henry Cabot Wade's thin shoulders were stooped, for the cabin, although comfortably appointed, was low-ceiled. The last of the Wades was not as rich as his forefathers had been. As the family fortunes had shrunk, so had their sailing craft. "I think that this is the spot, Captain Manly." Wade's voice was thin, New Englandish like the bite of frosty air. Jeremiah Manly nodded. He spoke in a slow, twangy drawl. "Yes, these are without doubt the two islands indicated on the chart. The strait between is the proper width, and our surrounding indicates 6 fathoms of water." Wade smiled bleakly. "I suppose it is too late to begin the search today." "Yes, the sunlight is fading. We'll remain at this anchorage for the night and begin work around 10 in the morning." Wade's precise smile broadened. "That glass-bottomed boat should get results in quick time. This isn't a wide channel." For a moment he squinted at the chart. "I wonder what we'll find. Black gold. What a secretive way for my revered ancestor to put it down on paper. 10 tons of black gold. And he hid this chart away in the bottom of his personal chest, so carefully. What is black gold?" Both men stared down at the chart. It was enigmatic. That black cross marked at the mouth of a narrow strait that ran between 2 small islands. But more enigmatic than the aged chart was the incoherent message written in irregular angular letters across its face. "Here lies 6 fathoms down 10 tons of black gold, and I know now that for this crime I am accursed. May God have mercy on my soul." Captain Manly cleared his throat in embarrassment. "You know how your ancestor Ebenezer Wade got his wealth, I assume?" The owner's lips curled in a thin smile. "Oh yes, Captain," he assented, not at all apologetically. "He ran slaves. He bought them on the west coast of Africa and sold them in Savannah, New Orleans. There was money in it. We Wades, until the stock market up and busted us, always made money. Buying furs from the Indians, running loan banks, plunging in stocks. We were always exploiters, we Wades. Don't worry, Captain Manly. I know the bourgeois opinion of our family. But, as man to man, it's the only way to get along." Captain Manly did not lift his eyes from the chart. "Perhaps," he said then dryly, "a great many people seem to agree with you. But all this is beside the point. Mr. Wade, did you ever hear the old story that your great-grandfather dumped a shipload of slaves overboard? One time a curious frigate chased him, that he never went to sea afterward?" Wade laughed sardonically. "No Wade would have been that soft." Captain Manly stroked his grizzled chin. He kept his eyes focused on the chart as he replied. "This is a narrow, shallow channel, Mr. Wade. A light vessel, if chase, would very likely put in here, where a square-rigged frigate might be expected to have trouble, especially with a quartering wind. It would give a man time to unload his cargo." "Slaves, smell isn't real evidence, Mr. Wade." For an instant, the small cabin was still. Then Wade smiled a trifle thinly. "You're trying to tell me that one of my ancestors was fool enough to draw a chart showing where he dumped overboard a shipload of slaves?" he snapped. "You don't know the Wades." Captain Manley's eyes lifted to the owner's finely chiseled face. "No person can say with certainty what another human being might do," he said quietly. Wade laughed harshly. "We Wades aren't human beings, or so a great many people have said. I'll go on deck now and join Evelyn." Slowly, as the owner stooped through the companionway, Captain Manley rolled up the chart. Thank heaven, Aunt Leona's gone to bed at last. Evelyn Phelps' clear, faintly metallic voice tinkled the words. With an appreciative laugh, her fiancé hunched his deck chair closer to her own and slipped his wiry right arm possessively about her shoulders. Behind their backs, the foremast, a naked black finger reared up towards the stars. The tropic breeze, balmy from the nearby Gulf Stream, fragrant with the scent of nearby land, whispered in their faces. The islands to port and starboard were low-lying, palm-fringed masses edged with gleaming white. The moon, climbing over the bowsprit, was bigger than an orange. Henry Cabot Wade chuckled. "Chaperone can be a nuisance on a night like this." The girl sighed. "Isn't it lovely? Boston seems so far away and money so unimportant." For an instant, while the thought of their desiccated family fortunes swept between them, they were silent. No one knew better than they that if this search for black gold proved a failure, she must marry someone else. Restlessly, Henry Cabot Wade stirred. "We'll get it up," he promised her, the words hard. "We have to search every inch of this damn channel. We've brought the best diver money could buy. Dynamite enough to blow up a city." She turned toward him and kissed his cheek, the fringe of his eyelashes, his thin, cruel lips. She admired his profile, sensitive, aquiline, somehow like that of a great predatory bird. They made love, while the moon crept from above the bowsprit to the foremast. Suddenly he stiffened, sat erect. "Look there," he said sharply, pointing forward. Then he shook his head bewilderedly. "It's gone. Did you see it?" She was touching her disheveled hair into place. "See what?" she asked, her voice sleepy and warm. "I didn't see anything." Puzzledly he muttered, "I thought I saw a head appear momentarily above the rail and then vanish. It was just a sort of dark blob. Optical illusion, I guess." He shrugged, looked at her, unresisting in his arms. For long minutes they loved. Then abruptly, he loosed her, turned his head to peer forward. He had heard distinctly a soft, naked shuffling behind him. And in that instant, a strangled, high-pitched scream burst from his lips, and he was stumbling, scrambling to his feet, his face ashen, his mouth and eyes hideous with terror. "Run, Evelyn, run!" He was flailing out with his fists in the moonlight, flailing out into emptiness. Swiftly she rose, took one step toward him, but he motioned her back. "Run, run, get Captain Manley. I'll hold him off as long as I can." She found her voice then. "Henry Cabot Wade," she said sharply, "have you gone suddenly crazy? Or is this your idea of humor?" He did not seem to hear, and suddenly her flesh crawled. His right fist, lashing out frenziedly, had jolted to an abrupt halt, as though it had struck something she could not see, and slowly, step by step, he was backing toward the rail. She could see his face now, half turned toward her, and she could see that this was no play acting, that whatever was happening was, to him at least, horribly real. And still his fist lashed out, until suddenly his left arm lashed out no more, but remained close to his side, tugging, struggling weirdly, as though pinioned to his body by invisible hands. And through his screams came nightmarish words. "Run, Evelyn, run! For God's sake, get help! They're swarming over the rail. They're too many for me. They're big slaves in rusty chains." The words ended in a bubbling moan. His right hand clawed frantically at his throat. Like a puppet dangling at the end of invisible strings, he rose up and over the rail, backward, and vanished from sight. There was a hollow splash. Evelyn heard her own voice babbling incoherently. Intermittent, chill waves of terror swept over her, waves of terror and of horror, for she knew that no man could have leapt like that over the rail, and the deck was moon-bathed, serene in its utter desertedness. Captain Jeremiah Manley stood at the Marianne's rail, earphones clamped to his head, looking down into the gray, gently heaving channel. His face in the early dawn was pale, and there was an odd quaver in his voice as he talked in low tones with a diver 30 feet below. Except for the rhythmic soughing of the pump and murmur of his own words, there was no sound on the Marianne's deck. Evelyn Phelps was below, asleep. Her aunt had given her morphine. The three members of the crew who were on deck did not speak. The diver's mechanical speech came through the earphones. "All right, haul away. Then bring me up. I'm getting the jitters." Half a minute later, Henry Cabot Wade's body, the end of a half-inch rope knotted beneath the armpits, came over the rail. The sailors put the dripping corpse down gingerly on the deck and covered it with a tarpaulin. The diver came up next, bulbous and cumbersome in his heavy suit and helmet. While the sailors stripped him of his helmet, Captain Manley took the earphones from his own head and put them down with a sigh of relief. The sewing of the pump had ceased. The diver climbed out of his suit, left it lying in a dripping heap on the deck. He looked at Captain Manley, and Captain Manley saw that the pupils of his eyes were enormous. Suddenly he began to tremble. He was afraid, now that he was safe on deck. When he spoke, his voice was a croak. "They were down there, dozens of them. Skeletons picked clean by barracuda and shark, all linked together by one endless chain, with half a ton of ballast on the end." Captain Manley's lips moved, but no distinguishable words came forth. The diver sat down weakly beside the pump. He did not look towards the tarpaulin-shrouded form. Wade was tangled up in him. There was 20 or more of them piled on top of him. They broke all apart when I touched them. And one of them, right on the bottom of the pile, had him by the throat. I had to pick the finger bones out of his neck. And the strangler wore this thing. He extended a peculiar-looking ornament toward Captain Manley. Both men stared silently at the object. It was a necklace of enormous teeth, curiously carved and bound together by a thin golden wire. Captain Manley cleared his throat. His mouth felt oddly dry. "God," he said, and slowly. "He must have been a witch doctor, a shaman. I read about such things in the National Geographic magazine. He must have put a curse on the Wades." The Burned House by Vincent O'Sullivan. One night at the end of dinner, the last time I crossed the Atlantic, somebody in our group remarked that we were just passing over the spot where the Lusitania had gone down. Whether this were the case or not, the thought of it was enough to make us rather grave, and we dropped into some more or less serious discussion about the emotions of men and women who see all hope gone and realize that they are going to sink with the vessel. From that the talk wandered to the fate of the drowned. Was not theirs, after all, a fortunate end? Somebody related details from the narratives of those who had been all but drowned in the accident of the war. A Scotch lady inquired fancifully if the ghost of those who are lost at sea ever appear above the waters and come aboard ships. Would there be danger of seeing one when the light was turned out in her cabin? This put an end to all seriousness, and most of us laughed. But a little tight-faced man, bleak and iron-gray, who had been listening attentively, did not laugh. The lady noticed his decorum and appealed to him for support. "You are like me. You believe in ghosts," she asked lightly. He hesitated, thinking it over. "In ghosts?" he repeated slowly. No, I don't think I do. I've never had any personal experience that way. I've never seen the ghost of anyone I knew. Has anybody here?" No one replied. Instead, most of us laughed again, a little uneasily, perhaps. "All the same, Strange enough things happen in life, resumed the man. Even if you leave out ghosts that you can't clear up by laughing. You laugh till you've had some experience big enough to shock you, and then you don't laugh anymore. It's like being thrown out of a car. At this moment, there was a blast on the whistle and everybody rushed up on deck. As it turned out, we had only entered into a belt of fog. On the upper deck, I fell in again with a little man, smoking a cigar and walking up and down. We took a few turns together, and he referred to the conversation at dinner. Our laughter evidently rankled in his mind. "So many strange things happen in life that you can't account for," he protested. "You go on laughing at faith healing and at dreams and this and that, and then something comes along that you just can't explain. You have to throw up your hands and allow that it doesn't answer to any tests our experience has provided us with. Now, I'm as matter-of-fact a man as any of those folks down there, but once I had an experience which I had to conclude was out of the ordinary. Whether other people believe it or not, or whether they think they can explain it, don't matter. It happened to me, and I could no more doubt it than I could doubt having had a tooth pulled after the dentist had done it. If you will sit down here with me in this corner, out of the wind, I'll tell you how it was. Some years ago, I had to be for several months in the north of England. I was before the courts. It does not signify now what for, and it is all forgotten by this time. But it was a long and worrying case, and it aged me by 20 years. Well, sir, all through the trial in that grimy Manchester courtroom, I kept thinking and thinking of a fresh little place I knew in the Lake District. And I helped to get through the hours by thinking that if things went well with me, I'd go there at once. And so it was that the very next morning after I was acquitted, I boarded the northbound train. It was the early autumn. The days were closing in, and it was night and cold when I arrived. The village was very dark and deserted. They don't go out much after dark in those parts, anyhow, and the keen mountain wind was enough to quell any lingering desire. The hotel was not one of those modern places which are equipped and upholstered like the great city hotels. It was one of the real old-fashioned taverns, about as uncomfortable places as there are on earth, where the idea is to show the traveler that traveling is a penitential state, and that morally and physically the best place for him is home. The landlord brought me a kind of supper, with his hat on and a pipe in his mouth. The room was chilly, but when I asked for fire, he said he guessed he couldn't go out to the woodshed till morning. There was nothing else to do when I hadn't eaten my supper but to go outside, both to get the smell of the lamp out of my nose and to warm myself by a short walk. As I did not know the country well, I did not mean to go far, but although it was an overcast night, with a high northeast wind and an occasional flurry of rain, the moon was up, and even concealed by clouds as it was, it yet lit the night with a kind of twilight gray. Not vivid, like the open moonlight, but good enough to see some distance. On account of this, I prolonged my stroll and kept walking on and on, till I was a considerable way from the village, and in a region as lonely as anywhere in the country. Great trees and shrubs bordered the road, and many feet below was a mountain stream. What was the passion of the wind pouring through the high trees and the shadow of the water racing among the boulders? It seemed to me something like the noise of a crowd of people. Sometimes the branches of the trees became so thick that I was walking as if in a black pit, unable to see my hand close to my face. Then coming out from the tunnel of branches, I would step once more into a great clearness which opened the road and surrounding country a good way on all sides. I suppose it might be some 3/4 of an hour I had been walking when I came to a fork of the road. One branch ran downward, getting almost on a level with the bed of the torrent. The other mounted in a steep hill, and this, after a little idle debating, I decided to follow. After I had climbed for more than 1/2 mile, thinking that if I should happen to lose track of one of the landmarks, I should be very badly lost. The path, for it was now no more than that, curved, and I came out on a broad plateau. There, to my astonishment, I saw a house. It was a good-sized manor, 3 stories high, with a veranda round 2 sides of it, and from the elevation on which it stood it commanded a far stretch of country. There were a few great trees at a little distance from the house, and behind it, a stone's throw away, was a clump of bushes. Still, it looked lonely and stark, offering its 4 sides unprotected to the winds. For all that, I was very glad to see it. It does not matter now, I thought, whether I have lost my way or not. The people in the house will set me right. But when I came up to it, I found that it was, to all appearance, uninhabited. The shutters were closed on all the windows. There was not a spark of light anywhere. There was something about it, something sinister and barren, that gave me the kind of shiver you have at the door of a room where you know that a dead man lies inside, or if you get thinking hard about dropping over the rail into that black waste of waters out there. This feeling, you know, isn't altogether unpleasant. You relish all the better your present security. It was the same with me standing before that house. I was not really frightened. I was alone up there, miles from any kind of help, at the mercy of whoever might be lurking behind the shutters of that sullen house. But I felt that by all the chances, I was perfectly alone and safe. My sensation of the uncanny was due to the effect on the nerves produced by wild scenery and the unexpected sight of a house in such a very lonely situation. Thus I reasoned, and instead of following the road further, I walked over the grass till I came to a stone wall, perhaps 250 yards in front of the house, and rested my arms on it, looking forth at the scene. On the crest of the hills, far away, a strange light lingered, like the first touch of dawn in the sky on a rainy morning, or the last glimpse of twilight before night comes. Between me and the hills was a wide stretch of open country. On my right hand was an apple orchard, and I observed that a stile had been made in the wall of piled stones to enable the house people to go back and forth. Now, after I had been there, leaning on the wall, some considerable time, I saw a man coming towards me through the orchard. He was walking with a good free stride, and as he drew nearer, I could see that he was a tall, sinewy fellow, between 25 and 30, with a shaven face, wearing a slouch hat, a dark woolen shirt, and gaiters. When he reached the stile and began climbing over it, I bade him good night in a neighborly fashion. He made no reply, but he looked me straight in the face, and the look gave me a qualm. Not that it was an evil face, mind you. It was a handsome, serious face, but it was ravaged by some terrible passion. Stealth was on it, ruthlessness, and a deadly resolution, and at the same time such a look as a man driven by some uncontrollable power might throw on surrounding things, asking for comprehension and mercy. It was impossible for me to resent his churlishness. His thoughts were so certainly elsewhere, I doubt if he ever saw me. He could not have been gone by more than a quarter of a minute when I turned to look after him. He had disappeared. The plateau lay bare before me, and it seemed impossible that, even if he had sprinted like an athlete, he could have got inside the house in so little time. But I've always made it a rule to attribute what I cannot understand to natural causes that I have failed to observe. I said to myself that, no doubt, the man had gone back into the orchard by some other opening in the wall lower down, or there might be some flaw in my vision owing to the uncertain and distorting light. But even as I continued to look toward the house, leaning my back now against the wall, I noticed that there were lights springing up in the windows behind the shutters. There were flickering lights, now bright, now dim, and he had a ruddy glow like firelight. Before I had looked long, I became convinced that it was indeed firelight. The house was on fire. Black smoke began to pour from the roof. The red sparks flew in the wind. Then, at a window above the roof of the veranda, the shutters were thrown open, and I heard a woman shriek. I ran towards the house as hard as I could, and when I drew near, I could see her plainly. She was a young woman. Her hair fell in disorder over her white nightgown. She stretched out her bare arms, screaming. I saw a man come behind and seize her, but they were caught in a trap. The flames were licking round the windows, and the smoke was killing them. Even now, the part of the house where they stood was caving in. Appalled by this horrible tragedy, which had thus suddenly risen before me, I made my way still nearer the house, thinking that if the two could struggle to the side of the house, not bounded by the veranda, they might jump, and I might break the fall. I was shouting this at them. I was right up close to the fire, and then I was struck by... I noticed for the first time an astonishing thing. The flames had no heat in them. I was standing near enough to the fire to be singed by it, and yet I felt no heat. The sparks were flying about my head. Some fell on my hands, and they did not burn. And now I perceived that, although the smoke was rolling in columns, I was not choked by the smoke, and that there had been no smell of smoke since the fire broke out. Neither was there any glare against the sky. As I stood there stupefied, wondering how these things could be, the whole house was swept by a very tornado of flame and crashed down in a red ruin. Stricken to the heart by this abominable catastrophe, I made my way uncertainly down the hill, shouting for help. As I came to a little wooden bridge spanning the torrent just beyond where the roads forked, I saw what appeared to be a rope in loose coils lying there. I saw that part of it was fastened to the railing of the bridge and hung outside, and I looked over. There was a man's body swinging by the neck between the road and the stream. I leaned over still further, and then I recognized him as the man I had seen coming out of the orchard. His hat had fallen off, and the toes of his boots just touched the water. It seemed hardly possible, and yet it was certain. That was the man, and he was hanging there. I scrambled down at the side of the bridge and put out my hand to seize the body so that I might lift it up and relieve the weight on the rope. I succeeded in clutching hold of his loose shirt, and for a second I thought that it had come away in my hand. Then I found that my hand had closed on nothing. I had clutched nothing but air, and yet the figure swung by the neck before my eyes. I was suffocated with such horror that I feared for a moment I must lose consciousness. The next minute I was running and stumbling along that dark road in mortal anxiety, my one idea being to rouse the town and bring men to the bridge. That, I say, was my intention. But the fact is that when I came at last inside of the village, I slowed down instinctively and began to reflect. After all, I was unknown there. I had just gone through a disagreeable trial in Manchester, and rural people were notoriously given to groundless suspicion. I had had enough of the law and of arrest without sufficient evidence. The wisest thing would be to drop a hint or two before the landlord and judge by his demeanor whether to proceed. I found him sitting where I had left him, smoking, in his shirt sleeves with his hat on. "Well," he said slowly, "I didn't know where you had got to." I told him I had been taking a walk. I went on to mention casually the fork in the road, the hill, and the plateau. "And who lives in that house?" I asked, with a good show of indifference, "on top of the hill." He stared. "House? There ain't no house up there," he said positively. "Old Joe Schneecker, who owns the land, says he's going to build a house up there for his son to live in when he gets married. But he ain't begun yet, and some people reckon he never will." "I feel sure I saw a house," I protested feebly, but I was thinking. No heat in the fire, no substance in the body. I had not the courage to dispute. The landlord looked at me not unkindly. "You seem sort of done up," he remarked. "What you want is to go to bed." The man who was telling me the story paused. For a moment we sat silent, listening to the pant of the machinery, the thrumming of the wind in the wire stays, and the lash of the sea. Some voices were singing on the deck below. I considered him with a shade of contemptuous superiority we feel, as a rule, towards those who tell us their dreams, or what some fortune-teller has predicted. "Hallucinations," I said at last, with reassuring indulgence. "Trick of the vision, toxic ophthalmia. After the long strain of your trial, your nerves were shattered." "That's what I thought myself," he replied shortly, "especially after I had been out to that plateau the next morning and saw no sign that a house had ever stood there." "And no corpse at the bridge," I said, and laughed. "And no corpse at the bridge." He tried to get a light for another cigar. That took him some little time, and when at last he managed it, he got out of his chair and stood looking down at me. "Now listen. I told you that the thing happened several years ago. I'd got almost to forget it. If you can only persuade yourself that a thing is a freak of imagination, it pretty soon gets dim inside your head. Delusions have no staying power once it is realized that they are delusions. Whenever it did come back to me, I used to think how near I had been to going out of my mind. That was all. Well, last year, being up north, I went up to that village again. I went to the same hotel and found the same landlord. He remembered me at once as the feller who stayed with him and thought he saw a house. 'I believe you have the Jim Jams,' he said. We laughed, and the landlord went on. 'There's been a house there since, though.' 'Has there?' 'Yes, it has been as well as if there'd never been one. Old Snedeker built it for his son. A fine big house with a veranda on two sides. The son, young Joe, got courting Mabel Elting from Windermere. She'd gone down to work in a shop somewhere in Liverpool. Well, sir, she used to get carrying on with another young feller about here, Jim Travers. And Jim was wild about her. Used to save up his wages to go down to see her. But she chucked him in the end and married Joe, I suppose because Joe had the house and the old man's money to expect. Well, poor Jim must have gone quite mad. What do you think he did? The very first night the new wed pair spent in that house, he burnt it down. Burnt the two of them in their beds, and he was as nice and quiet a fellow as you want to see. He may have been full of whiskey at the time." "No, he wasn't," I said. The landlord looked surprised. "You've heard about it?" "No. Go on." "Yes, sir. He burned them in their bed. And then what do you think he did?" "He hung himself at the little bridge half a mile below. Do you remember where the road divides? Well, it was there. I saw his body hanging there myself the next morning. The toes of his boots were just touching the water."